Any more confusion? No? Today I thought I would talk in a certain way about why Milton Babbitt is an endangered species. Quite a character, isn't he? I'm sure you enjoyed having him here. One of the trade magazines in the music business is something called Chamber Music America magazine. It's a comparable to, like, you know, Popular Mechanics for someone who's interested in cars or something of that sort. There was an interesting article in it last month that I thought I'd read you. It talks about the arts in general, but he's really referring to music because this is a music journal. It's read by professional musicians, mostly who play chamber music. And he's specifically talking about contemporary music. Do the arts have a future in America? If you are an artist, will you be asked to pursue your passion in the future? My answer is no. There is no future for artists in this country. Sorry, you've picked the wrong destination at the wrong time. You may not pass go, and you must go directly to business school, and then something essential like investment banking. That's how it starts. The way it ends, the experimenters, the scouts out ahead, are regarded with distrust at the moment. Our audiences have reverted to a desire for the familiar bill of fare. The shock of the new has always been difficult to sell to American culture, but resistance is at an all-time high. I have this persistent image of a Terminator who comes back from the future to 1991 to eliminate Mark Morris or John Zorn or B.B. Miller or Karen Finley because of their disturbance that their influence creates in the society of the future. No, there is no future for the arts. Rather clear statement, isn't it? It's a very fragile time for the arts in America right now for a lot of reasons, especially for music. The finances are obviously hurting things dramatically. I just heard that Stanford, for example, university that offers a large performing arts program in music is canceling their whole performing arts program now, eliminating totally. They decided to model Stanford after Harvard is what they how they put it. It's interesting because it was clear by the 50s that American culture was extremely vital. And in the traditional art forms, America had defined new ways of thinking about them. For example, the abstract expressionist painting we talked about, a new kind of novel that came out of the Beat Generation, Jack Kerouac, On the Road, that kind of thing. Also at the same time, America had invented or sort of adopted brand new art forms that didn't need to be compared to European art forms and were much more liberated because of that. I think a real good example of that is the movies. Hollywood movies became very much their own thing. And obviously there were European movies as well, but the Hollywood movie was a brand new thing. And because it was a brand new thing, new venues were created, the movie theater, whole idea of musicals, of comedies, of westerns, all came out of America. In terms of other musical forms, rock and roll came out of America because, again, it didn't have to face any of the restrictions of European music. Interesting comment I remember in the 60s, someone asked Bob Dylan if he liked the Beatles. And he said, I love the Beatles because they finally taught the Americans to like their own music. Also, by the it was obvious that new genres like jazz had come out of America. And these new art forms, in a way, thrived much better because they weren't in any way comparable to other things. Where classical music was, in a sort of ironic way, trapped into the European concert hall. And because it was trapped into the European concert hall, it was always compared with the European tradition. And the European tradition being so strong and so good in a certain way, it almost gave the public the feeling that Americans would always be inferior. I think a really good example of this right now is in the major orchestras in the United States. And I'm going to talk about major orchestras quite a bit today. And when I talk about major orchestras, what I mean, sort of like baseball, you know, there's major league and minor league. Well, with orchestra, there's roughly, 10 to 15, what we call major orchestras, largely because of budget. And the budget of those orchestras runs somewhere around $20 million. And the reason they're major orchestras is because they have the high budget, they can get the best musicians. Well, of all the major orchestras in the United States, only one has an American conductor at this time. I think that's the most any of them ever in history. Leonard Bernstein was the first American to ever become a conductor of a major orchestra, and he sort of established at least a precedence that it was possible. It's interesting because even the Boston Symphony has Seiji Ozawa, who's Japanese. And I have nothing against Ozawa. He's a wonderful conductor. But I just can't imagine the Boston Symphony ever hiring an American conductor. I could never possibly imagine the Boston Symphony in current time ever hiring any kind of minority conductor, like a woman, black, Chicano, anything like that at this stage. Because again, it comes out of this white male European tradition. So what's sort of ironic about new music in the concert hall right now is that the European model always was much, much more receptive to new music, and still is. Because in Europe, there was always a tradition of new music. And until the 20th century, really, almost entirely what was played in Europe was new music. The way composers in the old days used to make a living, like Wagner is a good example of that, was when he was a student, he copied music for the opera house, because the opera house only did new operas. So there was constantly a demand for people to copy the music. And it was a way to be an apprentice composer, because if you were studying music at the time, what better way is there to learn music than copying it? You can see it close up. European orchestras, in general, have much more flexibility about playing new music because of the fact that mostly they're state-supported. So they don't have to sell to a large audience like an American orchestra does in the same way. So constantly throughout European history, as I say, new music was supported and still is much, much more strongly. I have a friend who's a Dutch composer who's supported by the state in Holland, and he was giving a lecture a couple years ago, and one of the students said, well, how do you spend your day every day? And he said, well, I get up around 10, and I have my coffee, and then I go to my studio. And the government gives him this beautiful studio with a piano, and I work until about 4 in the afternoon. And then I go out in my boat, and I row on the canals for about an hour, and then I go home and have tea and take a nap, and then I go out every night. And I teach one day a week for 30 weeks. And he lives very well. I mean, it's a very upper middle class. The Dutch government gives him the money to live this way so that he can write music. Can you imagine the U.S. government giving John Cage money to write music? The U.S. government at this stage is sort of interesting to know. Established the National Endowment for the Arts in 1964 under the Lyndon Johnson administration. It was a Kennedy idea, the National Endowment. And it's always referred to as the NEA. And it's the main funding organization for the arts in the United States now. Now, per capita, the average taxpayer in America spends on the arts less than a half of a can of Diet Pepsi, about 24 cents a year. That's how much the U.S. government supports the arts at this stage. The U.S. Army Band, I'm not talking about the Marine Band, the Navy Band, any of those, the U.S. Army Band has a budget of 8 times more money than the National Endowment for the Arts at this stage. So you can see in a certain way, America is not very receptive about its own culture at this stage, certainly financially and in the concert hall. Now, it's also interesting that, for example, John Cage wrote a large opera, but it was commissioned by Frankfurt, not by the United States. And Frankfurt, Germany spent more on John Cage's opera than any other opera in their entire history. There's a new American opera by a composer who you've heard a little of, and we'll hear a little more later, John Adams, a brand new one called The Death of Klinghoffer. It's a big production with the director Peter Sellers. Both John and Peter came out of Harvard, as you may know. And this production was sponsored by Belgium. It will be done in the United States next year, but the production was paid for by the Belgian government, not by the United States. Now, there's a lot of reasons to account for that, and we'll talk about them in different ways. One of the problems that has happened in this century is the rise of something rather new concept of music is what we call the music industry. And the music industry, I'm not making up this term, it's used all the time. The music industry, obviously, is determined to make money. Now, in order to make money, you have to be able to market something. Let me regress just for a second and talk about something seemingly very different, but it'll come back in a second. A while back, I bought some land with an apple orchard on it, and I decided to make apple wine. So I bought all the books I could about how you make apple wine. And what the books all say to do is you take your apples and you wash them very carefully because the apples have natural yeasts on them. And these are the yeasts that make them rot or ferment, but you don't want those yeasts. And then you squeeze the juice out of the apples and you put them in a jar, and then you add a kind of sulfur tablet that kills any possibility of a natural yeast in it, and then you buy special yeast. You can get these at wine stores or you can send away for them. And when you do this, you get a great consistency from one bottle to the next. Every bottle of wine, if it's good wine, all tastes the same. So it occurred to me that people have made wine for centuries without being able to do this, because where would you get sulfur capsules, you know, back in 1800, and where would you get imported yeast? So I thought, well, what if you don't do anything? What if you just squeeze the bottle, squeeze the juice and put it in bottles and let it ferment? And what happens then is every bottle is a little different. They're not quite consistent. One might be really good, the next might have a slightly different flavor. Occasionally they're not very good at all, and so you let them sit for 2 years and you get great vinegar. Now, what if I wanted to sell my wine? Wouldn't you be disappointed if you went to a store and you bought a bottle of my wine and it was just great, right? You go back a week later, you're having a party, and so you buy another bottle and it doesn't taste like the last bottle. That's problematic. You might not ever buy my wine again. And this is where I'm getting down to marketing. And one of the problems with new music in marketing is you don't know what you're going to get. This is one reason that new music has become, in general, very much segregated from classical music, because when people go to concerts, for the most part, if they're paying money for it, they want to know exactly what they're going to get, or basically what they're going to get. And if something comes along completely unexpected, they tend to be not very receptive to that. So music, new music has become, in a certain way, almost ghettoized, so that concerts are only new music for those who are willing to take a chance, or only old music if you don't want to take a chance. Now, one of the ways that the music industry has marketed music over the years is through recording. And recording's interesting because, first of all, basically what people record in classical music has to be aged for at least 90 years, like a very old wine. Because if it's aged for at least 90 years, then there's very little chance that you're going to get something unexpected. It may be a different Mozart symphony than you've heard, but it'll be basically the same kind of symphony that you've heard. Then the other thing the music industry has done is recorded these pieces that have aged for 90 years for the last 60 years, roughly. And these recordings basically give a, let's say, a kind of window of interpretation of how the piece should sound. And if a young conductor, let's say, comes along and conducts it outside that kind of window of how you've heard it, you usually think it's a terrible performance because it didn't sound like it should, because the way it should sound is the way it's been recorded. Now, one of the really interesting ironies of this whole thing is that if you go out and, let's say, buy a Beethoven symphony and assume that's what it sounded like, you're probably very wrong, because the way an orchestra sounded in Beethoven's time is very, very different than the way an orchestra sounds right now. Let's take just a few examples. The flutes in Beethoven's time were wooden flutes, which are much softer, have a very different kind of tone, and they didn't have all the keys that a modern flute has on it. So consequently, the intonation or the kind of tuning it had isn't acceptable by modern practices. It wasn't until later in the 19th century someone came along and invented all these special keys that made the flute play better in tune. And one reason it didn't play very well in tune is that, like, you'd have to stretch really a long way between your third and fourth finger. So if you put on a little key so you don't have to stretch so far that presses the button over here a little further, then you can get it in tune. So the modern flute is really a very different sound. The orchestras in Beethoven's time, the strings, did not use metal strings, which is what orchestras use now, and they're very much brighter. They used what they call catgut, which was actually made from sheep's intestines. And the sound of gut strings is extremely different, much softer, much darker. The French horns in those days only played, remember we talked about the overtone series that certain notes occur in it? Well, if you take a certain length of pipe, it has what we call a certain fundamental. And then if you blow with different pressures on that pipe, you can isolate the different overtones. So basically the old French horn could only play in one key at a time. It didn't have the vowels on it that you pressed. And every time you wanted to change the key you played in, you had to change the pipe length. So there was a part of the horn that came off some pipe, and you put on a different pipe length. So you might take off a 3-foot length and put on a 4-foot length, let's say. Consequently, again, it was not the same kind of intonation at all as we think of, or the kind of sound that we think of at this stage. You know how when you go to an orchestra concert, everyone, they tune to a specific frequency. The frequency a lot of orchestras tune to is 440 cycles per second. It's fairly clear that most European orchestras tuned quite a bit lower than that in the 19th century. So the whole sound had a different quality. What's happened in the 20th century, partially because of the music industry, is these huge halls and huge orchestras exist. And in order to get a really bright sound, things like metal strings have been put on violins so that they will be brighter, they will go further. Another thing that's happened is that now most orchestras are tuning a little higher than 440 because the sound's just a little bit brighter. And that little bit brighter sound projects better in a concert hall. Another thing that didn't exist in the 19th century is what we call vibrato, you know, that sort of warble that, like, you know, opera singers do. The reason most people hate opera. Well, that came into existence. It existed in the 19th century, but only as an ornament. It didn't exist as the norm. And this is extremely clear. Like, there's a famous flutist who wrote a book in the 20s that said very clearly that he was the first person to introduce this idea of vibrato into an orchestra for a flute player. The same thing, there was a famous oboe player that wrote a book also, this is a little bit later, and he was the first person to introduce the idea of oboe vibrato. So it's ironic that we have come to accept this norm of what a Beethoven symphony sounds like with a modern orchestra as being the right way it should sound, when in fact it's very different than how it sounded. It's a kind of, again, a wonderful product of this notion of marketing. Also, the piano, by the way, was quite a different instrument in the old days. The modern piano, in sort of middle register, when you play a note, there's actually the little hammer's actually hitting three strings. And each of those strings has over 2,000 pounds of pressure on it. So this is a loud instrument. I mean, this can really fill this hall very well. The 19th century piano, which was called a forte piano rather than a pianoforte, was a much different kind of instrument, a lot more like a harpsichord, much softer, again, darker kind of color. Well, one thing that's happened with the music industry is it's become very expensive. And it's become quite global. In the United States right now, there is no longer any major record company owned by a U.S. firm. Every major record company in the world today is owned either in Japan or Europe. So if I want to sell a record, I'm no longer thinking about a local audience. I'm thinking about a global audience. So like when Leonard Bernstein was alive, if he recorded with the Vienna Philharmonic, it sold more records internationally than if he recorded with the New York Philharmonic. Sure, in the United States, the New York Philharmonic might have sold better, but they're not looking at it that way. They're looking at it from a global point of view. Now, the expense of modern music, or music in this period today, is enormous. In a major orchestra, you have to employ over 100 musicians. The reason you have to employ over 100 musicians is so basically they can play around 30 years of German music, which is basically over there. Before about Wagner and Mahler, you didn't need nearly so many people. But audiences of major orchestras expect to hear people like Mahler, Bruckner, Wagner, and in order to do that, you have to have over 100 players. In a major orchestra today, the absolute minimum salary, the very, very least any player has played, and these are the young people who are playing like glass violin, is $50,000 a year. It goes up from there. So today, to rehearse an orchestra costs around $10,000 for one rehearsal, just for musicians' fees. That doesn't include soloists, that doesn't include the conductor, that doesn't include the hall rental. For musicians' fees alone, it costs around $10,000. So consequently, orchestras are not in a position of taking risks very much anymore, because the most they can afford to do for a concert in the United States is about four rehearsals maximum. That's $40,000 there alone. San Francisco Opera budget is $33 million a year. They produce about 10 operas a year. So that means each production costs them over $3 million? I mean, that's expensive. So if they have a flop, they're in bad shape. Or if the people that give them money don't like the way they program, they're in bad shape. Consequently, what's happening in America now is a kind of Well, I guess you could even call it a kind of censorship that's taking place in the arts. One of the things about culture is, on one level, it can only function well if it's fairly stable. If every day things change drastically, it's very hard to function. I lived in Iceland once for 8 months, and the inflation there was over 50%. And you'd go to the store one day and think, well, maybe I'll buy this book tomorrow. And the book was $5 that day. You go back the next day, it was like $10. It just, everything was out of hand. You didn't know what to do. People who were borrowing money for their houses could only get loans for like 3 months at a time because the economy was so crazy. And it took like 3 or 4 days to go to all the different banks to fill out the paper. So you were constantly trying to deal with this unstable culture because of the finances. So on a certain level, you can't not deny the fact that stability is very essential for our daily existence. But on another level, culture changes, and there's always a kind of implicit skepticism about change with people because, again, stability is important. But change also becomes important. I remember about 6 years ago, I was having lunch with the head of the Polish Composers Union. They have unions for composers in Europe. We don't have that here. Anyway, the head of the Polish Composers Union said that literally, at one point of his life, literally, police with machine guns and dogs came to his house and told him he couldn't write music the way he was writing music or he would be arrested. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Well, last year in San Francisco, a photographer by the name of Jack Sturgis was being investigated by the FBI for over 17 months at a cost of well over $1 million. The reason they were investigating him was because the subject of many of his photographs were naked children. Now, he's a very respected photographer. He's in practically every major museum. The Museum of Modern Art in New York owns many of his prints. The quality of his pictures of naked children was an expression of the innocence of the children. He never took any pictures without knowing the family, knowing the child very well, having parent permission. He never published any of the pictures without the permission of the parents. There was never even the slightest hint in any of his pictures at all of any kind of sexual innuendo. There was always this kind of expression of the innocence of a naked child. Some of the children were 11, some were 12. So he was investigated for child pornography for 17 months, as I say, at over $1 million. The FBI came to his house, handcuffed him, arrested him, took every single picture he ever took all of his negatives, took all of his equipment, and arrested his assistant, handcuffed him behind his back, and kept him in interrogation for 18 hours. That's not much different than the Polish Composers Union, is it? Interesting that America's gotten to this stage. Now, the National Endowment for the Arts, I imagine you've kept up with a little bit of the controversy for the last few years, especially right before the Iran controversy. It was shortly before a political election. The National Endowment became kind of a hotbed for political discussion, especially with Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina. And Helms questioned the whole purpose of the NEA and even suggested that we end the NEA completely. Because he said many of the things they were funding, he questioned whether they were morally correct. And he went originally after another photographer by the name of Mapplethorpe, which I'm sure you've heard about. And the NEA took away funding from certain organizations that were showing his prints because Mr. Helms decided they were immoral. Now, what's interesting about this whole controversy is Jesse Helms' big point was through this whole thing that why should the American taxpayer pay for immoral art? Now, first of all, let's go back to the taxpayer. The taxpayer is paying 24 cents a year for immoral art. Of all of the projects funded by the NEA over the last, since 1964, only about 5 of them have ever been questioned in any way about being morally correct. So what it's costing the taxpayer is what? 0.00000 cents? I mean, it's an absolutely ridiculous issue. But it's this feeling that society must be pure and stable and traditional, and that the traditions are the most important things to uphold, and modern art is implicitly revolutionary, and so let's get rid of it. Now, one of the great American traditions, for example, is tobacco. And one of the largest tobacco industries in the United States gave Jesse Helms $200,000 for his last election. Jesse Helms, after that, was instrumental in getting the country of Thailand to sell American cigarettes into advertising. For 20 years, Thailand had a campaign against cigarettes. The United States threatened such strict trade agreements with Thailand but they have to sell American cigarettes. It's a traditional value. It's this is a funny statistic I just came across the other day. In 1989, 2,000 people died of cocaine and 390,000 from tobacco. In 1989, $50 billion was spent on health care. It's also interesting the tobacco industry does most of its advertising, about 50%, in ghettos. And most cigarettes are sold to poor people. Now, it's interesting that Mr. Helms had such an extreme campaign against Mr. Mapplethorpe's photographs, but on another level, because tobacco is a traditional American product, there's nothing that would stop him from promoting that. The other kinds of implicit censorship that happened because of this is really very much against minorities. Again, the European model being white male domination, it makes it very, very difficult for a woman to be a composer. This has gotten better, but it's still difficult, or a woman to be any kind of conductor. It's only been in the last few years, as I mentioned, I think, the last class I taught, that women have even been allowed in orchestras. And still in many European orchestras, there are no women. It's not acceptable. So you get these kinds of explicit censorship and implicit censorship because of the economy of the whole thing. Now, what this is going to mean, first of all, is that an orchestra, because it needs to function and make money, is not going to program contemporary music very much, because subscribers, for the most part, don't like it. I was sitting in a hotel room recently in between rehearsals, and I just took out the Boston Symphony's schedule for this year. This might be a little off because I did it quickly. They're doing 76 works this year. 32 are German, 17 French, 12 Russian, 5 English, Americans and Italians tie with 3 each, 1 from Czechoslovakia, 1 from Finland, 1 from Hungary, and 1 from Denmark. Of the 76 works they're doing, approximately 5% are American, and 3% are works written in the last 50 years. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? 3% of the entire symphony, the Boston Symphony season, is music that was written more than 50 years ago. Now, this is an interesting time gap that's starting to happen with this music industry thing. Because let's look for a second. When Beethoven was 20 years old, that would have been 1790, okay? If he hadn't heard any works that were written for 90 years before that time, he wouldn't have even been able to hear Bach. You realize that? Think of poor Mozart, what he would have missed. I mean, he practically wouldn't get to hear anything on this wall here if you went back 90 years from when he was 20 years old. So this time lapse now is starting to be very critical with the audience, and it's getting more and more and more because the repertoire is not moving up. It's hovering around 1910 at the most, and consequently, modern orchestras are segregating more and more and more current music from older music. Another reason that new music is not played is that much new music is difficult. We're going to talk about Milton Babbitt in a second. I'm going to show you exactly why his music is difficult. I'm going to give you a good example of that. And here we have we have an orchestra, and we have 4 rehearsals for an entire concert, 2 hours of music. That means the most I can devote to a piece of Milton Babbitt would be about 2 hours. If it's a 20-minute piece, that's not very much time at all. Orchestras are very strict about time. I did a concert with the San Francisco Symphony last year, and I walked into the first rehearsal, and the personnel manager came up to me and looked at my watch, and he said, "Oh, your watch is about 90 seconds faster than our clock." Orchestras start right on time. Rehearsals end right on time. Breaks are exactly 20 minutes, no more, no less. There's several people there to make sure all of this happens very efficiently. You're given a little flexibility when you start the break. You have a 10 minutes leeway. You can start it 10 minutes later, 10 minutes earlier, depending. That's the only leeway you have. Other than that, you have exactly 2.5 hours, 20-minute break. The one thing you do have is that the players come early and warm up and are ready to play. The one thing you don't have is any time for the players to practice their music. Orchestra players don't practice their music. They learn it in rehearsals. They leave their music on the stand. At the end of the rehearsal, a librarian picks it up. A librarian comes in the next rehearsal and puts it on the stand for them. They don't have time to practice because essentially an orchestra player has, with the orchestra, two services a day, which means that he either has two rehearsals or a rehearsal and a concert. That's a lot of playing for a player. I mean, in a certain way, that's, you know, 5-6 hours of playing. Then usually they supplement their income by teaching or if you're in Los Angeles, playing in the movie studios, if you're in New York, playing for recording, that kind of thing. So if you take a hard piece, number one, there isn't time to rehearse it, and there isn't time to practice it. Also, because mostly what orchestras play is music that's at least 90 years old, most of the schools don't teach young musicians how to think about how to play new music. And new music, like new science or new mathematics or anything like that, has brought up new techniques and new problems about how to play it. So consequently, most of the players hate new music because it challenges them and makes them feel embarrassed because they can't really play it very well. They don't have time to really learn it very well. They don't have time to rehearse it very well. And usually the audience hates it. Another thing about it that makes it very problematic, let's say they can play a Milton Babbitt piece. Well, let's say, compare that to Mozart. If they've played a new Mozart symphony they've never played before, they've played 10 other Mozart symphonies, they've played Haydn symphonies, they know how to think about all those things. So they know what the style is supposed to sound like. They've never played Milton Babbitt before, so how can they play with any kind of familiarity or musicality? They've never heard it before. They've never played it before. So consequently, most orchestras will only program contemporary music that sounds like old music, that's easy enough to be rehearsed in 2 hours, and that basically makes no demands upon the players that are very exceptional. And those are the kind of pieces that are programmed. It's interesting here at Harvard also that even in graduate seminars, very, very little music is ever analyzed that isn't at least 90 years old or older. I don't know if hardly any piece ever analyzed in any classes I know about at Harvard that's recent. Very, very rare. So this time gap is becoming very consequential in what's going to happen now in new music, and consequently is, as I say, ghettoizing new music. If you go into a record store, almost always new music is segregated from classical music, if you notice. You never see like Milton Babbitt next to Bach. It's always like in a bin over here, and usually has pretty ugly covers. We call it the new music ghetto. Usually it's badly distributed. It's very, very hard to find new music records anywhere. And again, it's this category. Think of when you go into a record store. Everything in the record store is neatly categorized, isn't it? Here's jazz, here's classical. My favorite one, I don't think they use this anymore, but my favorite one in the old days was easy listening. That's a really good one, isn't it? Easy listening. Now, you know, because of these categories, maybe I haven't heard this record, and maybe I haven't even heard this group, but it's in this category, so it's not going to surprise me very much, so I can take a chance. I can go ahead and try it. Look at what rock and roll has become in some ways. It's really very much the last 20 years imitated what it did 20 years ago. You're not really surprised when you buy a new rock and roll album. It fits very clearly into heavy metal or light rock or, you know, the various categories that it's been. The innovations in rock and roll have not been musical ones. They've been in the production end of it. And the production end of rock and roll has made, it's sort of like putting a new package on Cheerios. It's still basically the same cereal, but it's packaged nicer and looks a little bit better. So let me read you, before I go on, little quote from the I Ching when I was starting to think about this lecture. I think it's a rather nice one. The line says, "He gets his head in the water, danger. After crossing a stream, a man's head can get into the water only if he is so imprudent as to turn back. As long as he goes forward and does not look back, he escapes this danger. But there is a fascination in standing still and looking back on a peril overcome. However, such vain self-admiration brings misfortune. It leads only to danger. And unless one finally resolves to go forward without pausing, one falls a victim to this danger." Now, what's happened is this new music ghetto, in a sense, has forced the composer, or many composers, into the university. And the university has become the new patron. A composer like Milton Babbitt could have never existed in this country with the kind of music he's written if he didn't have the university support. There was a very fine singer I did a concert with last year by the name of Bethany Beardsley. And she did a concert with a very famous pianist by the name of Charles Rosen, and it was a new music concert at the Brooklyn Museum. This was in the 50s. and they were premiering a new work of Milton Babbitt. So they were all excited, and they went out to perform, and there were two people in the audience, Milton Babbitt and the guy who hired them to do the concert. So the university has become a kind of sanctuary for experimentation because it's no longer necessary to be financially successful, which it is with an orchestra. An orchestra, if they lose money, if they lose subscribers, they will fold. The university can house a Milton Babbitt. A university like Harvard has, just one second, I'll take it. Like Harvard has two senior composers that are paid very, very well and don't teach very much, and basically they're here so they have time to write music. Yeah. I really don't see a lot of that happening, to tell you the truth. That's why I looked at the Boston Symphony's repertoire this year. Boston Symphony tends to be the most conservative in the country in a lot of ways. One of the steps that was taken, which has helped a little bit, is that Exxon Corporation gave major orchestras money to hire a composer in residence to advise them about what new music to play. And many orchestras did this and actually did improve their programming. Boston Symphony was the only one that was proud to never have a new music advisor. They would never accept one. Even though there was funding for one, they would not take one. Even the composer in residence thing, like Philadelphia Orchestra has agreed now, because of their composer in residence, who's from Harvard, Bernard Ranz, has agreed to do 1/20th century work on each one of their programs. I'll get just one sec. On every one of their programs. But mostly what you look at their programming is like from 1910 or 1920. So again, it's only 80 years old. It's not 90 years old. Almost no works from the last 20 years, though. Yeah. Reaction? You mean against this whole system? Oh, yes. If you look at the programming of orchestras, most of the contemporary music that is played is very palatable. It sounds like old music, sort of with a few new tricks. It doesn't have any kind of challenge about it. For example, for some unknown reason, Philadelphia Orchestra decided to program Milton Babbitt once. They tried twice to get through the piece. They canceled two different performances of it because they simply couldn't deal with it. But if you look at, I'm not going to mention names, certainly, but if you look at the composers that they do, and you listen to their music, you would have a hard time really knowing that it was written right now, although it might be a little more sparkly or something like that. No. Because, again, if I want to have a piece played by an orchestra, it has to be able to be rehearsed in 2 hours, and it has to be easy enough so you don't have to practice it. Okay? So the good part about the university is that it gave the composer a sanctuary where he could go and get away with what he was writing. Another really good thing about the university, quite frankly, and I think most composers who work in university situations will agree with it, is by being around young students, it keeps you alive, it keeps you thinking. It keeps you thinking of new ideas. You don't get stuck in your old habits. And I don't know of hardly any composer who teaches in a university situation who doesn't have this kind of feeling that it's not that he's just giving to the student something, but there's this, that the composer's also getting something back by being around new ideas. That's the good part of the institution. The bad part of the institution is obvious. For one thing, it's very isolated. This isolation has become kind of a torment to a lot of, especially the younger composers that feel like no one's listening to their music. The other thing that's really a danger of this whole notion is self-perpetuating academicism. There are a whole bunch of universities that give PhDs in music. I don't know what that means. PhD in composition. What does it mean to be a doctorate of composition? Does that mean you've mastered European style? What does it mean you've mastered? Does it mean you write good music? So there's become a kind of generic contemporary music that's, again, like we're talking about, fairly accessible, fairly palatable, has a lot of craft about it, does everything correctly, and if you write that kind of music, you have a much better chance of getting a job in a university. If you don't write music like that, let's say you write more like John Cage, you have almost no chance of getting a job in a university. If you're in the university, then what are you doing? You're teaching other people to keep doing that same thing so that they can get a job in a university and teach other people to do the same thing. That's the bad part of it. That's the very bad part of it. Now, with Milton's music, let me just show you why it's hard. If I have time, I might not finish this today, but we'll resume next time if I don't. I'm going to put a rhythm that he wrote on the board, and I'm going to explain it to you in a lot of detail, because I think it will illustrate very well why the Philadelphia Orchestra couldn't play Milton's music. I'm going to put it in musical terms, but I will explain it to you in a second. For those of you who read music, this probably isn't any more comprehensible than those who don't read music. You probably can't even see it. Anyway, I'll explain it to you. What this is here is he's got five notes that a person's going to play. In this case, it's going to be a cellist. These five notes, there's four time units in this, like four pulses that each are about half of a second each. Okay, during three of those, he wants you to play five notes evenly. Okay? Now, how would you figure that out? Now, again, this is not a complex problem if you just think about it. Let's say I divided the board into three units, and I wanted then to put five lines in the space of three units. How would I do that? I go back to my fourth grade arithmetic, and I find a common denominator. So I divide each unit of my three units into five. And then now I have three groups of five. But what I really want is five groups of three. So I would play a note here, note here, note here, note here, note here. So visually now I've divided, or spatially, these three units now into five. Okay, now how do you go about learning that? That's a difficult thing to learn. What you have to do is you start very slowly. You think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, let's see if I can get two different sounds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1. That's slow. I used to learn this, by the way, when I was at college. There was a long walk between all of my classes, and I would keep one rhythm this way and count the other. So then you start speeding it up. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1. Or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1. You hear the three here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1. I'm a little off. Wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1. That's how you do it. First, you start real slow and you count it many times, and then what you do is you get what is called the feel for it, because you can't count that many that fast. Obviously, you're not going 1, 2, 3, 4. So you have to get the feel of how it sounds, and you keep doing this and practicing it until you can do 5/3. So that's fairly hard, and almost no musicians in Western music have been trained to do that, although any Indian musician can do that easily. Now, I said there were four time units in this thing. So that accounts for three of them. Babbitt says, start this figure 2/3 of the way through one of the time units here, and then you'll have 1/3 of a time unit left at the end. So it's not simply 5/3. It's 5/3 moved over by 2/3 of a time unit. So if I wanted to figure that out, my common denominator now is 45. I'm not going to put it all on the board. So I have to put all of these in 15 units. So if I had 15 here, then you start thinking these time units in your mind and you displace it. So it comes out like this. Here's a bar for, here's two beats. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, this isn't so bad in a way if you're playing by yourself. because, you know, what if you're a little off? Who would know? But in Babbitt's music, he has like two or three people playing this at the same time. And he might have someone just playing on the fourth unit with someone else. So there is no way of, like, doing this simply. Now, you can bet for sure that the members of the Boston Symphony, number one, wouldn't know how to think about this, and number two, would never have the time to practice it. To learn a rhythm like this can take several months. You're going to hear a solo flute piece of Babbitt in about a week. It's about a 9-minute piece. The woman playing it has played lots of Babbitt's music, and it's about a 6-minute piece, and she's rehearsed it for almost 2 months, about 3 hours a day, in order to be able to play it. And she has no trouble with rhythms like this because she's already learned them. So it's absolutely impossible to put a piece like Babbitt's into a concert hall with an orchestra. It's inevitably isolated. Next time I'll go on with Babbitt a little bit and we'll make the transition into Carter. Carter's a little bit more practical than Milton, but not a great deal. So I'll see you, Friday?